Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country.
A new report from the United Nations Weather Agency has given a 3 out of 4 chance that the next 5 years will average more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures. That's the international safety limit set in 2015. There's an even higher chance, 86%, that one of the next 5 years will smash the global heat record set in 2024. And next year looks like a leading contender. So expect more extreme weather.
I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. And it's as good a time as any to talk about the weather, what it's doing to land masses and water here on Earth, and what some are doing to find relief on the moon. Let's start with WCCO in Minneapolis.
Report co-author and climate scientist Melissa Seabrook pointed to unmatched May heat in Europe this week.
It's unprecedented to have such hot temperatures in May before the meteorological summer has even begun.
The next 5 winters in the Arctic are also predicted to be nearly 3 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the last 5 years. Meteorologists also forecast an Amazon drought that may spark wildfires. I'm Karen Chemas.
Let's check in on our Great Lakes with WWJ in Detroit.
Can you explain the term forbidden soup?
I have to give credit to that for my PhD student, Lauren Hart, who is the lead author on the paper. But generally speaking, what she's referring to there is that her work and this paper show that Lake Erie harmful algal blooms are a soup of a mixture, a dense mixture of many different chemical compounds, many of which we're actually still discovering. So many of them are novel. And the concern is that some of those compounds may have health impacts on wildlife, on the ecosystem, and on humans. So, we know very well some of the toxins that these harmful algal blooms produce. Microcystin is the one that we really worry about a lot in terms of affecting the water quality, drinking water, safety, and recreation out there in the Great Lakes and other lakes. But what Lauren has discovered is that there are these other molecules, and there's some evidence that some of them may have toxic properties that are out there in complex mixtures. So that's what she means by a forbidden soup, that there's a soup of these different compounds out there.
So are these compounds all naturally occurring, or are they combining with things that are not natural to the water, maybe some man-made things?
Yeah, great question. The compounds are all naturally occurring in that they're produced by the algae. Okay, so these are, in particular, a photosynthetic cyanobacterium, actually several different photosynthetic bacteria called cyanobacteria. And so it's natural bacteria that are producing these compounds, but these algal blooms are unnatural in the sense that they're being fueled by nutrient runoff from human activities, chiefly farming. And so even though these bacteria are naturally occurring, they're proliferating to much greater densities and much greater extents than they would if it weren't for human activities like farm fertilizer running off of farm fields into streams and into our lakes.
So what, what would be the danger here? I know the recreation side of it might be more difficult to enjoy some of the Great Lakes, but the wildlife, there's a danger there. Are those the two primary issues, or is there drinking water issues, some other things like that?
Yeah, drinking water is a major concern, and that was really highlighted and underscored by the experience of Toledo, Ohio in 2014. And during that, there was an event in which these toxic algal blooms got into the municipal drinking water system of the city of Toledo. And the city of Toledo, over 400,000 people, were without drinking water for a long weekend. And so, there's a real threat that these toxins produced by algae can get into drinking water systems. So that's certainly a concern. We mentioned recreation, but one of the new insights into these harmful algal blooms is that the toxins can actually aerosolize, meaning they can get up into the air and form aerosols and be transported through the atmosphere. And so it's not just swimming and coming into direct contact with these algal blooms, but it's potentially breathing the air that could be harmful to people that are out there on the water or potentially even on beaches. And we know that these toxins can get into the air, but we don't yet have a good sense of exactly what risk that poses to human health. But that's also a concern as well. And then, yeah, as you mentioned, there's potential threats to the ecosystem. These harmful algal blooms disrupt the food chain. They can impact oxygen concentrations in lakes and really impact the health of the ecosystem.
So when you talk about the impacts of oxygen, we know how, you know, fish kills happen and things where there's a lack of oxygen inside the water, and all of a sudden you start to see all this dead fish washing up. So is that kind of what you have to wait and see what happens after a big thaw on the Great Lakes, let's say, once the ice starts going away? Is that when you start to really realize the impact of these blooms?
These algal blooms actually don't occur typically until later in the summer. So it's not going to be right when the ice thaws. There's other types of algae blooms, diatom blooms, that can occur then. But the ones that we're talking about here, the toxic ones, typically don't occur until about July. And they really peak typically in August and into September. So they require warmer water temperatures that we don't usually see until the summer months.
So really, what do we do about these things? So you know that some of these ones you're talking about start to peak in a few months. Do you start treating the water? What do you do to anticipate these things?
Yeah, that's a great question. Harmful algal blooms can be treated on very small scales, like, you know, your neighborhood lake or pond. But the Great Lakes are simply too big to be treated. You know, we don't have enough chemicals or other types of treatments that are really effective at that scale of the Great Lakes. And so really the only option that we have for management is to reduce the amount of nutrients that are going into the lakes. Those are the nutrients that are fueling and causing these harmful algal blooms. And so that can come through a variety of different mechanisms. The state of Ohio, for example, is investing a lot through its H2 Ohio program in reducing nutrient runoff off of farm fields. That includes things like best farming practices, you know, to reduce the amount of fertilizer that's put on fields, to think about what is the optimal timing of fertilizer application, how is the fertilizer applied in a way that prevents nutrient runoff, all the way to things like constructing wetlands, restoring wetlands that slow down the flow of water into the lakes and allow for more nutrients to be removed. But really the main way to address these harmful algal blooms is to reduce the amount of nutrients that go into the lakes.
This may sound like a stupid question, but so when you're talking about fertilizers and farms and things, why not just incorporate like an algae side into it, so with the runoff actually takes care of the algae on the back end of it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the main limitation there would be cost, right? That's going to be very expensive to apply at that scale across all of the farm fields. And who's going to bear that cost, right? Are farmers going to pay for that? Is the government going to pay for that? That's something that hasn't been addressed. And then finally, many algicides have collateral damage, right? They might be toxic to other organisms or potentially harmful in terms of the food supply. So that's a challenge as well, coming up with an algicide that really targets the algae but doesn't have other impacts on either the ecosystem or potentially on human health.
While our Great Lakes are staving off a soup that no one would want to eat, Louisiana is talking hurricanes. Here's more with Tommy Tucker on WWL in New Orleans. Cynthia.
Hey, gang, it's Jill Schlesinger. I'm launching a new show. It's called Money Moves, and we are going to move. We are going to answer your financial questions and take the mystery out of your financial life. Follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Lee Sheng, president of Jefferson Parish. What's on your radar as you head into hurricane season?
Well, actually, later today, we're going to do our annual hurricane press conference. And really, we do that annually at the start of hurricane season just to get on people's radar that, you know, this is the start of hurricane season. It's time to prepare. You know, even though there's not a storm coming, you don't wait for us to get in the cone before you prepare, and getting a plan together and having those conversations just with your family and putting it in your mind of what needs to be done and some things that should be done now. Like, you know, everybody should know that if they have to evacuate, they need a car that's in working order. Well, this is the time to get that done, right? Or I need prescriptions filled, and let me get enough prescriptions to last me through the hurricane season if I can, right? Those are the kind of things that you can do now while it's a blue sky day, while it's a calm day, that really make all the difference when you start feeling the chaos. We all know that, you know, we kind of get that nervous feeling and, you know, we see ourselves getting in that cone and a storm's coming. You're going to wish you did all this stuff now when it was beforehand. I hope people pay attention and make those decisions in their lives that they have to do. And I'm a big believer in, if you kind of think about something ahead of time and mentally prepare yourself, then when it comes time to action, you're already ahead of the game.
Dr. John Abraham from the University of St. Thomas joined the Adam and Jordana show at WCCO in Minneapolis to talk more about the extremes happening in our weather and what we need to do to prepare.
Hey, can I start with this question? I know we have other things, and we want to talk about all of the studies that your team is working on and the new results. But David and I read a piece that the Dead Sea is shrinking quite a bit, like 3 meters a year. It's a lot. And my thought was, is this just a normal evolution of the planet? Obviously, it's shrinking because of man-made issues. The Jordan River is getting diverted to both Jordan and Israel for drinking water and for crops. And that's what we do with fresh water. And then, is it worth saving?
A few things are happening. Well, first of all, the Dead Sea is below sea level. Okay. So it's in a valley. Now, why is that important? Because the lower you go, the warmer it gets. Think about climbing to the top of a mountain. It's colder. Mm-hmm. Go down lower, it becomes warmer. So that is contributing to this. Mm-hmm. But you hit the nail on the head. We are doing a few things that are affecting the sea level or the ocean level of the Dead Sea. And as you pointed out, it's decreasing by about 3 feet per year. That's a lot.
It is a lot.
We are diverting water from the Jordan River, and that's being used for agriculture and for drinking in urban areas. We are also farming minerals out of the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is very fruitful for minerals. And the way you get those is you pull out water and you extract the minerals from that water. And then in addition, the climate has changed in that area. It's become hotter and drier. So you've got three confounding things that are happening. If you rank order them, the diversion of water from the Jordan River is the most important one. And so, yeah, we could save the Dead Sea, and there's a lot of value in having the Dead Sea there. But there's also a lot of value in re-diverting that clean water. And, you know, you get to these water rights issues. We face these in the western part of the U.S., right? You know, if you've got a water that's going to, if you've got a river that's going 1,000 miles, everyone along that river relies upon that water.
For sure.
What happens?
Colorado River.
Exactly. And what happens if the people upstream take more than their fair share? And how do you decide on fair share? So it's a complicated problem.
You mentioned you have, and while you're here, a couple of studies, some major studies coming out.
My team at the University of St. Thomas has coupled with on two major publications, one in Nature and one in Science. Those are two different journals. And they both deal with oceans. One of them focuses on how fast is the ocean rising and can we account for it? So you think about your bank account. You got money flowing in, you got money flowing out, and you've got expenses, and it all should match. It should be consilient with each other. We've had a gap between how much ice we knew was melting and how much the oceans were rising. This new research project closed that gap. The second project, and I don't know if you like geese. Do you like geese?
Well, I don't like the geese poop.
Yeah. Well, the singular of geese is goose, and goose is also, G-O-O-S, is an acronym that scientists use for a global ocean monitoring system where a bunch of countries put money and funds into this system to monitor the oceans. And we ask the question, what if a country, oh, I don't know, like the U.S., would pull out of an agreement? How would it affect the accuracy of this global network? And so that was the focus of our second study.
More fragile than we thought. That's the title for one of your new studies here. First of all, explain how widespread ocean observation is and what information we get from ocean observation.
How do you measure ocean temperatures in enough spots, distributed enough to get an accurate picture? We use buoys. We use temperature sensors on ships. We use robots that are moving around the ocean, going up and down. They go down about 2,000 meters, about 6,500 feet, and then they come back to the surface, measuring all the way down and then all the way back up. And then when they get to the ocean surface, they send that data to labs. We use what are called moorings, which are sensors chained to the ocean floor. We also use animals. We put temperature sensors on seals and other animals that can swim under ice because we can't get our temperature sensors there. So we have this whole collection. It's a network of temperature sensors. And we want them spread out uniformly around the planet. We want as many temperature sensors in the Indian Ocean as the Southern Ocean, as the Atlantic, etc. And if you don't equally spread out those temperature sensors, you'll get what's called a biased view of the temperature. Like, let's say you put all of your sensors in the Mediterranean Sea. Well, then if the Mediterranean Sea heated up or cooled down, you'd think, oh, the whole ocean's heating up or cooling down. You can't obviously do that. So you need to have a distributed group of sensors spread out all over. And you have to measure the climate over years, because climate is not weather. Weather is what's happening right now. It's what you just read from your fancy weather map. But climate is changes year after year after year after year, so you have to monitor for a long time. And to solve that conundrum, to have enough sensors in enough locations, there has been an international organization of countries, non-binding, but countries that have put a lot of resources into putting these sensors out there. And there is a real concern that if – well, the question we wanted to ask is, let's say a country backed out. Let's just pick on Japan. Let's say Japan backed out. And let's say they have 20% of the sensors are Japanese. Well, what kind of error would we get in our measurement? Turns out you get more error than the percentage of sensors that are removed. So if Japan pulled out 20% of the world sensors, we would have an error of about 35% of ocean warming. If the U.S. pulled out sensors, we would have a much larger error. So, you know, you think about what happens if you lose 1% of your temperature sensors. It's not a 1% error. It's actually magnified. And that was the real finding that came out of this. It's the importance of continued temperature sensing network. It helps us understand weather. It helps us predict what's going to happen this year. Where's the rain going to fall? Where are the hurricanes going to hit? So these temperature sensors are really, really important.
Did every country agree that borders an ocean to help you? And who paid for all of this?
Japan, Australia, China in Asia are the big ones. Mm-hmm. And then in Europe, well, we have Brazil and Argentina and South America. And then in Europe, we have France, Germany. Italy has been a big contributor, and England. So and Canada has done some to some extent. So it's not all countries, but it's a number of generally developed world wealthier countries that have entered this non-binding contract and say, listen, we want to work together to monitor the oceans. I mean, it's great. That's why international collaboration is great. We want friends, right? We go to our friends in Japan and say, listen, we'll cover the Atlantic and the southern part of the Pacific. Could you cover the northern part of the Pacific? Hey, India, could you put some sensors in the Indian Ocean? And by stitching together a collaboration, you can cover everything. And no one country has to bear all the costs.
So is the U.S. threatening to pull out of this agreement and eliminate some of these sensors?
Well, the U.S. has cut funding to NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which really is the driver in the U.S. behind our engagement. We haven't seen widespread reductions yet, but we're really concerned about the funding in the pipeline to continue our infrastructure so that we can make these measurements. And for folks thinking, you know, these scientists have a bunch of expensive sensors out and they're wasting a lot of money. I'll tell you, what's that phrase? Penny wise, pound foolish. Our measurements of the oceans are cheap, cheap, cheap. But our ability to tell farmers, hey, this year you can expect 25% rainfall, less rainfall. Or our ability to tell Miami, hey, listen, this hurricane is going to hit. And we've got 5-day warning. Let's get out. I mean, the kind of economic value we get from that far outweighs any of the costs of these sensors. So it's not an economics issue. It's a issue related to our commitment to our international partners to better understand our planet and to be able to prepare for it.
Now, anyone who thinks they have to swim in a forbidden soup of toxins or prep to run for their lives because a hurricane is coming might be looking for a better place to live. How about the moon? Here's more from Tommy Tucker on an attempt to take another look at moondust.
Chris Marvel joins us, an assistant professor of mechanical engineering at LSU, and Emma McCarthy, a mechanical engineering PhD student at LSU. Tell me what you guys are doing with, it's not moon dust, you got to simulate moon dust first, right?
So basically, we bought a lunar regolith, which is moon dust, a simulant from a company called Space Resource Technologies. And we're trying to modify it to see if it could be used for in-situ resource utilization, also known as ISRU, which is a big NASA initiative, especially with the Artemis missions going on right now. So the long-term idea is that instead of bringing every material from Earth, we could potentially use materials already on the moon for things like construction or manufacturing for future Artemis missions and other things going on the moon.
And I hear now that Chris Marvel joins us, assistant professor of mechanical engineering at LSU. Chris, what surprises me, and keep in mind, you got to keep this on an eighth grade level with me. So it's simulated moon dust, so everything that is on the moon we have here on Earth, and we can compound it together to make it the same as moon dust?
Yeah, so we do have some general idea based on the way the moon dust or lunar regolith is composed. So there's different companies down here that make some different examples, and that lets us as researchers be able to go in and play with it a little bit, process it, so that way we can figure out, well, once we do get to the moon or Mars, how can we actually engineer it and then move forward?
So, Emma, what is it you're trying to accomplish?
So we're trying to extract usable materials from the lunar regolith that's already on the moon. And usable materials are things like aluminum or pure iron in order to either construct smaller things or repair things on the moon. And so basically, all of that is already present in moon dust, but it's bonded to oxygen. So it's aluminum oxide or iron oxide. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to separate the iron and the aluminum and the other materials found in moon dust, separate it from the oxygen in order to get that usable metallic aluminum or usable metallic iron from the moon dust, and then we can use that for other things on the moon.
And so what we're talking about then, Chris, is setting up some kind of mine or something, or some kind of, I hate to say foundry, how would you describe it, on the moon?
Yeah, so one of the things that we're researching at LSU is what we call a ball milling process. So we essentially would take the moon dust, put it in a container with a bunch of grinding media, and then shake it. So if we were going to do this on the moon, what we would do is essentially build a small manufacturing plant. So the lunar regolith is really everywhere. So if you imagine, what we could do is just scoop some off the surface, put it into some of our manufacturing mills, and then process it, and then we're good to go. So that's what makes it so exciting. So lunar regolith is everywhere, and there's different compositions depending where you are on the moon, but we essentially have this infinite resource that we can use. So we just need to build these plants, which we think is possible.
So how would you even go about building a plant on the moon? Because you're talking about a construction project. The only thing we've done so far is walked around and hit some golf balls and drove around, right?
Yeah, so certainly. So there are big aspirations by NASA to start building some structures on the moon. So the big problem is we do have to ship up a lot of our materials, which you can imagine is quite expensive. And as Emma mentioned before, that's why we're doing this in-situ resource utilization. So once we start building things, we hope that we can use these thermite compounds that we're making to help us build structures. It can help us weld. It can help us join materials together. So it's a way that we can really help build things once we ship it up there. So, and with us being able to get aluminum or iron, the thought is, rather than having to ship up all of these metals that we typically use on Earth, how can we actually synthesize them and extract them on the moon surface instead? And that'll reduce our resupply needs.
So when you say facility, how big are you talking about? Are we talking about like a warehouse or something or what?
Yeah, no, I think we can do a little bit of everything. So the ball mills that we have in our labs at LSU are little tabletop units. So they're not much bigger than, say, your dishwasher. Mm-hmm. So we can do those sorts of things. We can install these ball mills on the International Space Station, do some little experiments that way. And to your point, one of the things we can do with the products that we make is we take the aluminum, we take the iron, and we can actually use what we extract for 3D printers. So we can make small components, or we can make really big things. NASA is very interested in, say, extracting aluminum in particular to use for wire additive manufacturing. So we can use it to repair things. We can also use the heat that's generated to help power other components. So we think it's a pretty versatile, powerful method that could be used in all sorts of ways.
What kind of time frame are you looking at on something like this happening?
I would say right now the time frame is pretty large because right now we're really focused on determining the feasibility of our ideas, essentially. Mm-hmm. So determining if the ball milling is affecting the microstructure of the lunar regolith, how it's affecting it, and then also developing ways that we can characterize it in order to better efficiently optimize our processing techniques for our ideas. So it is a it is at the very, very early stages right now of our ideas.
That's pretty cool if you think about it. If you look further down the line where maybe, you know, decades from now, years from now, y'all had a hand in something like this. Thank you both for taking the time. It's very interesting work. Chris Marvel, Assistant Professor of Mechanical Engineering at LSU, and Emma McCarthy, Mechanical Engineering PhD student at LSU. And if a facility is built, I hope it's made purple and gold.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.